that running a veterinary business can sometimes feel like you're fighting your way through a jungle of financial insecurity, HR nightmares, and overall business confusion. Our goal is to give you the ideas and tools you need to not just survive in this jungle, but to thrive in the veterinary industry. By combining over 50 years of knowledge and experience with differing opinions and a little humor, we will help you get the information you need to make the best decisions for you and your veterinary business. Welcome to the Veterinary Survival Show with veterinary CPA and certified financial planner Mark McGaughan and certified veterinary practice manager and practice owner Jenny George.
Welcome to this edition of the Veterinary Survival Show podcast. I'm Mark McGaughan, CPA to the Veterinary Stars, here with Jenny George, CVPM, owner of Deerfield Veterinary Hospital. We're here with Dr. Peter Weinstein. I've known Peter for 20 years almost since I joined the Vet Partners group back in Kansas City in 2003. And he's been a luminary in the industry. I've always looked up to him and his guidance and his periodicals and whatever I've read and seen him speak. I know Jenny as well. Jenny considers him a mentor.
So welcome.
Let me know when Dr. Weinstein gets here. I'd love to meet him.
He's an awesome guy.
He's probably pretty cool.
Seems to be. So yeah, we wanted to have you on because you said something to me once about disrupting the veterinary industry. And I want to know, what does that mean to you and why is it important to you?
Jenny, do you know the difference between a grave and a rut? The depth and the length of time you're in it. The veterinary profession, since Noah and extending into James Herriot, has been in a rut. And if it keeps in that rut, it will be our grave. It is time to get practices out of that rut and into a new way of doing things. COVID showed us we can do that, not by choice, but by virus. And my feelings are it is a great time to disrupt the veterinary profession.
So are you talking the veterinary industry in general? Are you talking private practices? Are you talking corporate medicine? Or are you just talking like everything?
Yes.
But Peter, haven't we been in a period of disruption? And I'm saying corporate consolidation is a period of disruption that I think the industry really needed. I read an article today in Veterinary Business Periodical that a doctor lamented that he had a high volume, low cost practice, was generating $2 million in collections a year, 18% profitability. He sold it to a corporate and immediately they raised the fees, lost a lot of the patients, and they lost him. And I'm like, what do you think was going to happen? So wasn't he part of the problem? He had a great thing going. He was serving an underserved community, and then he wrecked it himself. I mean, should he have just kept it going, found some other way to continue it, sell to associates, not look for the greater payday? It's kind of like Dow 36,000 back in 1999 when I used to work with the super wealthy. Wow, this is going to continue forever. And magically, it imploded, just like corporate consolidation did. It's going to rear its ugly head again, I think, sooner in another fashion, but when you say disruption of everything, I think it's a good thing, but somebody has to take the lead and do it well.
I think there's a lot you just said that needs to be unpacked as well. If we look at corporate consolidators, in many ways, they have changed exit strategies, but they haven't exactly gone in and changed the way veterinary medicine delivers veterinary medicine. They have added a layer of administration, which means you now have to be more profitable. Because not only do you have to pay the bills within your facility, you have to pay the administration of the corporation that buys you. But they're not going in and changing how we see clients. In many cases, they're not defining how we set our standards of care. What they're just doing is changing our exit strategy for their benefit, because they can then get a recap and sell on the stock market, et cetera. But have they changed the delivery model for veterinary medicine, whereby veterinarians are seeing clients in a different fashion, are more effective, are more efficient, or are we still delivering Dr. Herriot's single doctor approach, doctor-centric model in a world that needs to move towards client-centrism and team-centrism?
I like the idea of team-centric veterinary medicine. We've talked about that on this podcast. That's how we practice medicine. We're very much like, trust our team, give them jobs that they can do, and it makes us more efficient, makes us more profitable. I do understand that there are some veterinarians out there that don't like to just let go of that power. They think it's my job. And one of the things that we've talked about before is that in veterinary school, that's what they teach, is these technical skills. So then veterinarians are coming out of veterinary school and they think, well, I'm supposed to be the one drawing the blood. I'm supposed to be the one placing the IV catheter. I'm supposed to be the one monitoring anesthesia. So if we're going to really disrupt the veterinary industry, does that start as early as veterinary school?
Yes, actually it starts before veterinary school. It starts in the recruiting of future veterinarians. And it starts in the recruiting of future veterinarians that have predominance of EQ and a balance of IQ. Because veterinary medicine, ladies and gentlemen, is not a healthcare provider. Veterinary medicine is a service industry that delivers healthcare. And the sooner we figure that out, and the sooner we surround ourselves with people who can actually conduct a civil conversation with our clients at the professional level, all the way down to the animal caretaker level, the sooner we will be able to provide a value proposition for clients that are becoming more and more demanding.
Well, and I think it's not just that they're becoming more demanding. There's more information out there for them. Our clients are now more educated. No matter what we say about a recession, they have more money that they are willing to spend on their animals. There's information that they're getting from everywhere. The breeders, the humane societies, the people working at pet food stores, the pet food companies themselves.
Animal Planet.
Animal Planet, Discovery Channel, Disney Plus. All of this information is out there. And I find that the veterinary industry really fights against that and poo-poos all that. But the reality is we just need to accept that information is out there. So how are we going to combat that instead of fighting tooth and nail, because that's the way we've always done it. So that's how we need to keep doing it.
Information is not knowledge. Knowledge is power. We as a profession need to control the messaging, but we don't. We've let everybody else control the messaging. We are a very passive profession, and we have not really done a very good job of self-promoting and letting pet owners truly understand everything that we know and understand. I mean, get on an airplane and tell somebody you're a veterinarian, and you'll have 5 hours of talks that go back to the 1920s about how their dog died under ether anesthesia, having a dentistry done, and they think that's how we still do it. And when you start to talk to them about kidney transplants, when you tell a client that you can take radiographs at your practice, and the client says, you mean you can actually do that here? You guys take radiographs? When you say, well, I want to get a blood sample. How do you get a blood sample from a dog? We have not done a very good job of self-promotion. And I'm not suggesting we want to prostitute ourselves, but what I am suggesting is that we should be controlling the messaging. And we're not. We have become victimized by every other source of information, instead of being the go-to source for information.
Shouldn't the national regulatory bodies and veterinary associations take the lead on that? You would think AVMA would be the god of information or direction for the public, because I think most regulatory bodies want to protect their members, but also protect the public or inform the public as well.
You're correct. I think it's up to the membership of these associations to help the association leadership understand that we not only need advocacy at the governmental level, but at the consumer level. And again, it goes back to my statement that we're a service industry. We've done a very good job on the healthcare side, but we really haven't done a good job of promoting that skill set of healthcare to our consumers of our services. And it's very difficult for Jenny in New Hampshire to spend the amount of money that's necessary to get the word out, even in a small town. But it's much better if everybody came together and we promoted the profession as a whole instead of trying to promote each of us individually. There's enough business for the entire veterinary profession to be busy. We don't have to worry about competition. But what we have to do is make sure we do a better job with clients getting the messaging regarding preventative care, regarding desexing procedures, regarding all of the different skill sets that we have. But instead of doing it globally, 35,000 hospitals do it individually.
Now, is that the fault of when I go to conventions, both on the dental side and the veterinary side, when I see the guys at the Yankee Dental Conference in their purple jackets noting their membership. These guys use walkers, have gray or no hair, and they look like something back from the 50s are running the organization. In other veterinary organizations, is it the same group of old white guys and we need an influx of power from 32-year-old females that predominate the industry? I'm 60 years old and I always learn things from somebody that's 25 or 30 years younger than me. Why can't the veterinary industry do the same?
I refuse to answer that question on the grounds that it may incriminate me. In organized healthcare, medicine, dentistry, etc., the leadership represents the past because the current is busy being a doctor and doesn't have the time all the time to be in a leadership role. But I would say that what you commented on is how do we get the generation that's going to be most influenced to be in a position of influence? And it's very hard from the time commitment standpoint.
I mean, it's hard to go back in time and say, boy, I wish 25 years ago I had stepped up to the plate and made my voice known.
Well, 25, 30 years ago I did, and I have, and I continue to. But I do think it's important, and I'm going to speak on behalf of organized veterinary medicine. I think it's important that every veterinary hospital be involved with organized veterinary medicine and take advantage of the fact that they are out there advocating for you for the rules and regulations within the state of New Hampshire, the state of California, the state of Massachusetts, because you can be a victim or a victor. If you want to sit there and wait for change to occur, then be a victim. If you want to have a voice, be a victor.
I think a lot of what you just said, though, about the time commitment is a big issue. Here I am running a business, 3 kids to raise. Also, I'm involved in my church. I'm involved in the school, all of these things. But we're just talking about the governing board. Simon joined the New Hampshire Veterinary Board, and he was on it for 5 years. Now one of my other veterinarians is on it for 5 years. They have the same time commitments that I do. And unfortunately, a lot of what the veterinary board, I think, does is more disciplinary, but they are really big on changing. Right now, we just had a lot of changes to our Veterinary Practice Act, and that defines how we practice veterinary medicine, what our techs can do, all of these things. And so many veterinarians got all up in arms about it, but nobody said anything beforehand. So if you want change, and this is in every aspect, if you want change, you have to do something about it, and you have to step up and make the time. Figure out how you're going to make that happen. While yes, I don't think that there are a lot of brand new veterinary grads that are going to be able to run AVMA, just because I do think that there needs to be some experience there. But I agree that there needs to be, I think, better communication between the governing bodies and who they are governing. We could be talking about the United States government right now, but we're talking about the veterinary industry, because I think that people don't know how to get a question even out there or get it answered. And do they even know their state vet? I mean, I am in a very small state. California is its own entity. I can't even imagine how you get any information. I can call. I have my state vet's phone number memorized. I can call them anytime and get answers. How do you do that in a bigger state? I think there needs to be a better communication there. And then maybe we could open it up more so that these younger veterinarians can say, hey, why don't we have ads out there? Why isn't the AVMA bigger on Instagram and Facebook and social media? And to that point, you said that the veterinary industry is relatively passive. Do you think, too, that this can go back to the recruiting for veterinary school? I tend to find that a lot of veterinarians have that similar personality of being people pleasers, which is good. In a service industry, it is very good. But it also means that we tend not to be big on our own public relations. Could that change also in the recruitment?
I think if you look for EQ over IQ, yes. First of all, let's do some clear definitions. The Veterinary Medical Board is the regulatory agency. The Veterinary Medical Association is the advocacy group. They don't always interdigitate. In most states, the veterinary medical boards are consumer advocates and the veterinary medical associations are professional advocates. I'm suggesting you should be a member of your national, state, and local VMAs, veterinary medical associations, who will go to bat for you with issues that are part of the veterinary medical board. It is paramount that the veterinary medical associations level of communication is to the grassroots level. And if we want to create change in a profession, it's really bottom up, grassroots to the top rather than top down, which means the issues that impact small town New Hampshire that could impact big city Los Angeles, New York, Boston, everybody should know about. And it shouldn't be after the fact. It should be when it's occurring. We did some podcasts recently on xylazine. There are so many veterinarians who had no clue that xylazine was being mixed with fentanyl and causing a huge worsening of the opioid epidemic. And now I got to believe in your practice, because it's a mixed practice, you have a boatload of xylazine that is rife for the picking if somebody wanted to break in and steal it. So should you be aware of that the minute that becomes an issue? Yes. Not after you're victimized, but because somebody took the time to say, you need to start locking up your xylazine. Oh, and by the way, you can't lock it up with your DEA products because that's a DEA violation. And you probably don't even know that from that standpoint. This is why we need to educate our own members and give them knowledge. And that same knowledge should be the same messaging that we all want to give to the consumers that are out there.
How do we get started on that? Like, how do you propose? We've talked about changing the recruitment, veterinary school, changing private practice, all of these different things. It's such a big task. Where do you start? How do we do this?
Peter, doesn't your daughter know what she's in for?
She knows what she's in for. It's funny because she said, didn't I just see you guys do a podcast on xylazine? Because I don't tell her everything that I do. And I said, yes. She said, oh, is this something else I have to worry about? I said, yes. So yes, Brooke graduates. She's going to have these issues and others to understand and deal with. And so as part of the veterinary curriculum, and I know most of the veterinary schools do this, we need to talk about these issues from day one, whether it's part of an ethics class, whether it's part of an issues class. And I think we should be discussing them. I teach at the veterinary school out here. And I teach business, and I have an hour that I take about AMA, Ask Me Anything. And we will talk about cost of care and access to care. And we'll talk about DEI and all of the different issues that are out there. This needs to be part of the conversation, because we shouldn't just be learning about kidneys and livers and hearts, oh my. We really should be learning about the issues that impact us and will allow us to do a better job of delivering healthcare in kidneys and livers and hearts, as opposed to preventing us because there's a regulatory event happening where we didn't take a strong enough stance and a law is changing. So it's got to be at all levels. And what we have in this profession, and since you opened up Pandora's box, I'm stepping right in. What we have in this profession is a lot of silos. We have associations, state boards, colleges, et cetera, technicians are a silo, that don't come together and cross-pollinate. So we tend to work a little bit in a too self-serving, self-interest fashion, instead of what can we do collaboratively to solve some of these issues. It's all about collaboration and cooperation.
If you look at the veterinarian's oath, it says the promotion of public health is part of it. I think this is like a fundamental thing that can help change the mindset, is if we really look at the fact that advocating for veterinary medicine, both within our own organizations and to the consumer, is a way of us promoting public health. It might make the veterinary industry be a little bit more open to, oh, maybe I will talk a little bit more about what we do. Because then it's going back to that oath that you took as a veterinarian. It takes it back to that oath that I am promoting public health. Yes, we did know about the xylazine thing. I remember in the late 90s when they were breaking into the veterinary clinic that I was working at to get, I believe it was Proin, to make methamphetamines, to the point where my veterinarian had to put bars over the skylights. And this is in Colorado, but nobody talked about it, but it was happening. So that's part of public health, right? Is keeping our drugs locked up properly, how we sterilize our, all of these things come back to public health, not just anthrax and rabies, these things that you barely ever see. So I feel like if we go back to that and use that as a, here's why we need to promote ourselves, do you think that that would change kind of that mindset a little bit and maybe people would be a little less shy?
Absolutely. Think about the following. The coronavirus that completely effed up the world in 2020 had an animal vector. So it's essentially a zoonotic disease, But how much veterinary medicine was actually talked about in terms of zoonosis? I mean, talk about a great opportunity for public health education and One Health education. We missed an opportunity. I think we could have had a much greater impact by advocating for the fact that this was zoonotic. Avian influenza right now is a radical issue. I'm talking to the CPA to the stars over here. Sometimes as a small animal clinician, we are so busy being busy that we are so focused on the 35-inch level that we don't see the 35,000-foot level. And I think that's what I'm trying to advocate for, is that if there's a responsibility as a small business person to understand the issues going on within your business, but also to understand the issues external to your business that can influence your staff, your team, your practice, your business, and your ultimate profitability.
Veterinarians are overworked for the past 3 years plus. Is this just one more aspect that they are like, oh my God, another thing on my plate? Can't they outsource this to someone on their team that is knowledgeable, well-spoken, educated, can be a face of the practice, can be their representative to the industry?
You're absolutely correct, Mark. I think when people ask me what is one of the first things a hospital should do when they can afford to do so, is hire a manager. If they're large enough, hire an administrator. Call them what they want. Jenny's heard me do this talk before, and Mark, you may have heard it at some point in time, but veterinarian owners have three hats to wear: technician, manager, and entrepreneur. We do one of those well. That's the technician. We're good doctors. We don't manage really well. We don't entrepreneur very well. Just put us in a room, put us in a surgery suite, whatever it is that you want it to do. We do that well. So if we can build the comfort level to have somebody we can trust manage the practice and help us set a vision for the practice, so few practices actually have a vision or a direction. We really do live Groundhog's Day every day. And I think part of what I'm talking about is changing the vision for the profession, changing the direction for the profession through changing the business, changing what we need in terms of veterinarians coming out, changing maybe even the guidelines to choose veterinary students to go into veterinary school, et cetera. I think we've got to all work together collaboratively to figure out how we can start to take some of the stressors off. Because, yeah, why are people breaking into hospitals? And why do hospitals have substance abuse and theft within their hospital? Because of stress. Where did the stress come from? Stress comes from money. Stress comes from people. Stress comes from not ever failing before in veterinary school or life, which is a high IQ issue. But EQ people tend to be able to deal with some of that from a greater resilience standpoint. So I said a lot, and I was on a soapbox a little bit there. But that's why I think we really have to look at more global changes that impact a lot of what we do. And even the business models. We've been doing it very much the same way. The model that Jenny has in her practice, even though it's got a lot of technology and a lot of resources and cars that work, is the same model that James Herriot had in the 1920s. In the UK.
Well, Simon's name could be James Herriot.
No, it's Simon's name is the Viking, okay?
Don't tell him that, please. But the James Herriot thing, I think you're right. I know that when we started our practice, our goal was everything that we said, we're going to do it differently. We know how it was done. We want to do this differently. We want to do this differently. And we are to a certain extent in that we are team-centric. We try and pay our team livable wages. To help remove some of those stressors, right? That's the reason that we opened up a daycare, because we had a plethora of babies and these people still want to work. So it's thinking outside of the box. We're talking global, but I think too that it's important to remember that you can start in your own house, in your own yard, in your own clinic, and look at the changes that you can make yourself that maybe aren't so overwhelming of, we're going to change the AVMA and the whole message of the veterinary industry. Look at what can you do within your practice differently and stop saying that's the way we've always done it. I hate that. And it's true because it's easy and we don't like change and we're comfortable in this is how we've always done it spot. But we've got to start looking at things from a new perspective.
I have a slide of human lemmings jumping off a cliff. The cliff is named veterinary medicine because essentially that's what we have done. We've always been followers, Jenny, how do you know what your fee schedule is? You call the practices in your community and find out what everybody else is charging. Instead of saying, well, I'm going to charge whatever I want because I figured out from a financial standpoint how much I need to earn, how I'm going to do it, and you actually do real calculations, we don't stick our neck out very far. We're like the perpetual turtle or ostrich when it comes down to it. And you're absolutely correct. Change comes at the grassroots level. Change comes from somebody doing something that works and talking about it. And somebody says, oh, I never thought of that. Let's try it. And they try it and it works. And now all of a sudden it becomes a song and everybody's singing it. The problem with veterinary medicine is we've got way too many different songs all being sung at the same time. So instead of having music, we have cacophony.
I heard you and Dr. Dave Nickel do a talk on how to make veterinary medicine fun again. And I thought, these are my people. Like, this is what I've been trying to, like, it doesn't have to be so humdrum serious. We come in, we don't tell jokes, we don't talk to each other, we do the job, we go home. I'm like, if I want to work in a place like that, I don't know, work at a grocery store. I want to have fun and I want to be with my people. And you guys talked about that. And I remember Dr. Nickel said on his interview questionnaire for technicians, he listed a bunch of surgical tools and then he had something from Doctor Who. It's interesting because you go to these conferences and you walk away and you have this like, I'm going to go back and I'm going to change this. And I think that's where you can start getting ideas. Talk to the people next to you because they might have good ideas and just grow it from there, but do something. Because if you go to these conferences and you just come back and you're overwhelmed at all the information you just got and you do nothing, then nothing changes.
More small businesses fail from failing to change than from making the wrong change. You can always undo. But if you don't do, you're stagnant. You're in a coma. What we really need in many cases is defibrillation. So what I'm hoping is the fact that about 30% of the veterinary hospitals are owned by the Mark McGaughns and Peter Weinsteins of the world, old men. That as this generation, which is approaching retirement, sells to a generation of millennials and Gen Zs, and they want to do it differently, that they do it differently. And they're not afraid to do it differently. And they're not afraid to own a hospital that they only own halftime and somebody else owns the other half. Or is what if there were five owners? Three of them were doctors, one was a manager, one was a technician, and they each owned 20%. You just got to set up the governance and oversight from that standpoint. What if you had a morning doctor and an afternoon doctor, and they each work 5 days a week, or a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday doctor, or Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday? It doesn't have to be a 6 day work week at 60 hours. You just need to fill in the gaps, and you can do the same thing with your kennel staff. Maybe we shouldn't be open on Saturday because everybody's at Little League and softball and soccer. Maybe we should be open on Sunday afternoon. Maybe we need to look at the demographics and needs of our consumers and recognize that the millennials want to make appointments online. So do you need a receptionist to make appointments? Maybe they don't want to come in and pick up the prescription. What can we do about getting it to them through an online pharmacy or even mailing it to them? What are we doing to change our profession to meet the generational changes that now own 51% of the cash flow in veterinary hospitals and at least 50% of the employment in veterinary hospitals? And the answer is not, we've always done it this way. It's, what are your ideas? What would you suggest? If you were a client here, how would you like us to do things?
Some of the consultants that I work with say you should say no more, but that's no to more work or additional responsibility. What they should be saying no to is operating in the same way they've done for the past 20 years.
I have a book on the shelf that says, when I say no, I feel guilty.
I don't. I've gotten really good at saying no. But that's something that you have to work at and practice. A lot of what you've talked about can be worked on if, as you say, we start changing how we get recruiting the veterinary students, in that you are looking for, yes, they have to be smart, but do we really have to just memorize anatomy? Or are we looking at someone who can communicate with clients? Listening skills are huge. These EQ, softer skills, I don't even want to call them soft skills because they're not. They're so important. So how do you change the recruiting method? I mean, do you do DISC profiling? How do you change? I mean, how many veterinary schools do we have in the United States?
35.
So how do we change it in each one of those veterinary schools to say, we are looking for a different type of veterinarian that is more open to change and not so afraid?
So as long as there is an oversight for how education needs to be provided and what education needs to be provided, that's the outcome. Who you put through that outcome is defined by the admissions guidelines at each of the veterinary school. Now, as long as the faculty can teach to the Council of Education guidelines, then whomever comes in, the goal is to get them to complete the curriculum and pass the national licensing exam. Can you do that by using screening that's not based upon grades? Maybe it's based upon work experience. And you've got to understand that there are some biases that occur in work experience because not everybody in a lower income community may have access to work experience. But what about work experience at a Target during Christmas? Talk about customer service and dealing with lunatics. That to me is huge. I want to see on an application that somebody worked in a service industry and knows how to communicate. So what if we start to rebalance what we use as guidelines to choose veterinarians to maybe have equal balance between life experience, veterinary experience, and academics? And they weigh the same because right now academics is overweighted. It's obese. We need to put academics on a diet.
To that point, you said that you have to teach them to pass the test. I know that a lot of schools are now looking at different ways to measure the success of their students. I remember when at first I was in advanced English and advanced math, and then they got rid of that. So then we were all shoved in classes together, but we all had to pass the same SATs, ACTs. Well, now some colleges aren't even looking for those. So could there be a different measurement too when vets get out of school instead of these national exams? So we're teaching you, again, critical thinking, but memorization also to pass these exams. Like, is there a different way that we could even look at that aspect of it? Not just what they're taught, but how they get out and have to pass. I know it's the same in the veterinary technician. They have to pass their exam. I have some of my team members that are brilliant, great at their jobs, and just horrible test takers, and they failed it 3 times before they passed.
I'm not sure I have an answer, but as long as the measure of success for the veterinary schools is the pass rate of the NAVLE, that's what they teach to. If the measure of success was 5 years out of school, are you still in the profession and enjoying it? We might have some different measures. We don't have enough time to get into depth on all of these different things. But I think one of the biggest problems that we haven't addressed is retention, because it solves a lot of the problems that we have on the manpower side of things. If we could keep people in the profession, both professionals, doctors, credentialed technicians, client service people, animal caretakers. What if we had animal caretakers who started at 16 and went through the process and then eventually went to veterinary school? I mean, to me, that is a home run. And then they come back and they want to be a partner. And then they want to buy the hospital. That to me is success. Not the fact that you can do a brain transplant on an iguana. To me, success is, have we created a profession that people look to as a career and not just as a job? That's success. How do we do that? How do we make careers out of our technicians that are more than 5 years? How do we have veterinarians last forever? And some of it is just the work environment. We need to teach toxicology to our practice managers because they've got to go in and detox their veterinary hospitals. How do we create a work environment that's more conducive, more supportive of the people? Some of that is thinking differently. Some of that is listening better. And some of that is providing a different environment where it's fun. In a very stressful world where animals die and people can be jerks, how can we have fun?
I'm currently reading a book called Positive Leadership by John Gordon. He says that you can look at the fruits of your labor or the fruits of your tree, right? And your fruits are your profits. Your fruits are your good patient outcomes. But you need to look at your culture, which is the roots of the trees. And you have to continually work at it. I can't say this enough. If you need to work on your culture, you have to be patient. It is not a fast change. You need your whole team on board, but you have to constantly work at it because it's not like, oh, I lost all this weight and now it's going to stay off. You can't go back to eating the way that you used to. You're going to put the weight back on. You have to keep working at it. So if you're working on your culture, it's the same thing. You have to keep working on it. It's not going to stay this healthy, happy, non-toxic place. And I think that's the problem is we get comfortable. We say, oh, we did the work. We're done. And then it goes back to being an unhappy place and you're losing technicians that you beg them to stay, or you're losing veterinarians and you can't find any replacements and on and on.
Culture trumps strategy and tactics, but we're real good at tactics. That's the technician side of things. We're not even really good at strategy, but we're really good at tasks, but we don't focus on the culture. As a student who may be listening to this, as a veterinarian who may be listening to this, as an owner, manager, etc., the culture and the environment in which you work will determine how you feel at the end of the day and at the beginning of the day. And it will determine if you're showing up on time and leaving early, or if you're showing up early and staying late. It's the culture that ultimately determines how comfortable you feel throughout the day.
Are these new veterinary startups that I see all over the country that are growing like weeds, that promote great culture, that promote limited hours, no overtime, fantastic benefits, is that the wave of the future or is that purely marketing?
Well, since you gave me a multiple choice question, I'll say yes, all of the above, because we don't know. The changes that we've been talking about are generational changes. This is not something that we can expect to have happen overnight. It took us generations to get here. By the way, small animal clinical medicine as a standalone is probably only 60 or 70 years old. It used to be mixed practice and it became a spinoff. So it's going to take a generation of change to ultimately see what the next generation is going to look like. But if we don't make those changes, the next generation is going to look just like it does right now.
I'm so happy that you came here to talk about this because I think it's a lot to get us thinking about what we can do personally to make differences and maybe encourage people to reach out to those governing organizations, your local VMAs, the AVMA, and just say, hey, these are things we need to start looking at and thinking about. So if you love Dr. Weinstein as much as we do, you can follow him and Dr. Phil Nelson on Peter and Phil's Courageous Conversations, where they talk a lot about disrupting the veterinary industry. A lot of really difficult conversations and difficult questions that need to be talked about. I've been uncomfortable sometimes listening, which is a good thing. It's okay to be uncomfortable. So you can find those wherever you listen to your podcasts, and also The E-Myth Veterinarian, which you wrote with Michael Gerber, which talks a lot about the entrepreneurial seizure. So you can catch all of us at the AVMA in Denver. We'll all be there. The AVMA Economic Forum. Dr. Weinstein and I will be talking more about team-based medicine. That's going to be an online forum in October. Anything else that you'd like to add?
Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for the platform. We scratched the surface. If you'd like to do this again sometime, we can get deeper into it. But I really enjoy just making people think and be uncomfortable, because I think that's what we have to do if we want to institute change. So I appreciate the invitation.
We can always do a part two and part three. We do that a lot.
Well, thank you all very much for listening. Catch us in the next episode. Be sure to follow us and like us and subscribe. And you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as well. Thank you so much, and be the change you want to see in the veterinary world.